Thank you for joining me on the Richest Podcast. For this episode, I spoke with Dr. Julian Chambliss, an associate professor of history at Rollins College. He's the coordinator of the Africa and African-American Studies programs at Rollins. I spoke with Dr. Chambliss about community-based research, specifically how he incorporates this approach to his teaching. Please enjoy the interview.
Okay, Julian, thank you for joining me today in the podcast.
I'm happy to do it.
And one of the things I'm sort of interested in getting at today is community-based research, and this is something I personally have read about because I'm also interested in the local history and the ways in which we can send students out to our local communities to sort of learn something and also kind of have easy access to resources and hopefully in some sense make a difference to a local organization or their own community. And so when I thought about wanting to interview someone about community-based research, I immediately thought of you, Julian, because I know you do a lot of great work with your students in the local community. So I'm wondering, how is it that you obviously got a position at some point and you were in the classroom. At what point did you say to yourself, okay, I want the students to go out into the local community, and I'm going to make that part of the classroom curriculum or a class assignment?
I think my experience began with a recognition that we had a very interesting local history here in Winter Park. And as a history professor, having newly arrived, I thought that local history, which intersects in very interesting ways with broader historical debates and transformations in American experience, provided a unique opportunity for students. And we have a historical society, and at the time that historical association, the Winter Park Historical Association, was really, I think, looking to partner more with us being the institution, Rollins College, and the history department, for a variety of reasons, hadn't really done a lot of interactions with them. And so my initial goal was a very straightforward one. It involved oral histories, and those oral histories were something that we were doing for the Historical Society, because as many people recognize, historical societies have a lot of passion, but many times don't have a lot of manpower or labor. And so therefore, getting the students up familiar with techniques and identifying sort of crucial people to talk to because of their age and the goals associated with what the Historical Society wanted to do became quite easy, an easy fit, easy relationship to develop. And then from there, over time, I got more involved and I would argue more sophisticated approaches to community-based research.
So did the project drop in your lap, or were you kind of searching for a need, like to serve a need or anything like that?
I was thinking about ways to intersect with the community. And once I started to do that, it easily dropped into my lap, right? I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about being in the position that we're in is as academics in the college setting, people who do local history, I think, often want to have a relationship with you, but also don't want to have a relationship with you. And it becomes a very difficult sometimes transition from you're sort of, I don't want to like simplify this, but you're in the ivory tower and they're sort of on the ground. And depending on how people feel at the institutions, you can walk in and say, I want to sort of interact, and it can be very, very helpful and very fruitful relationship. But you can do that exact same thing in a different institution or a different day at the same institution, to be honest with you, and it'll be very different. And so when I started to think about this, I had some interactions with the executive director at the time at the Historical Society. She was very, very open to it, very excited, and really it took off from there. We did the oral history project. That was a success. And very quickly from there, I started working with her and recognize, as I said, that there was a very complicated and very sort of interesting history in the community, and work with a colleague to develop a Florida Humanities Council grant looking at the Colony Theater, which has been transformed into a pottery barn, which is something I noticed immediately when I got here. I mean, within the first few days when I got here, I was like, well, that's a really interesting building. It still has its marquee. What's the story there? And that was what my colleague thought too. And she was in the English department at the time, and I was in history, and we both came from UF and both thought the exact same thing. That's a really interesting building. There's a really interesting story there. And we developed that with the Historical Society, and that was a huge success as well.
So did you, I hope I'm not misunderstanding this, but so one project kind of segued into the other, like as a result of the oral history, you learned about the theater? Or?
Well, as a result of the oral history, I had a very good relationship with the Winter Park Historical Association and its executive director at the time, Marianne Popkins. And when the opportunity came, when I was in touch with my colleagues, Denise Cummings, who at the time was in the English department, but now is in the Critical Media and Cultural Studies department at Rollins, when we decided we wanted to try for a Florida Humanities Council grant, they were our community partner. Like they were, because I had such a good relationship with her from our experience with the oral history, we went there and she was like, of course. And, you know, we applied for the grant, lucky enough to get it, and set up the exhibit, and that exhibit was a huge success. As I said, it allowed us to get into the archives, sort of interact with the community even more. At the same time, it really allowed us to think a lot about how we conceptualize Florida as scholars, and really we developed, I think, an interesting take on Florida as a kind of mediated space. And Winter Park is a kind of laboratory for that mediation in different moments, in different historical contexts, in different cultural moments. So it was very successful for us, and very successful for the history, Winter Park History Association, because that was a very big exhibit. It was up for a year. They got a lot of visitors from it, and because of their connection with us, you know, other academics in the region, like you, did an exhibit there, and that really sort of put them on a different track for a period, and it garnered them a lot of attention, which I think they, you know, worked very feverishly to capitalize on, because people became interested in what's going to happen next at the History Museum and so on and so forth.
And how did the students react to this? Because I imagine, you know, here, I know when I teach, I'm certain students expect to just come in, write papers, take tests, listen to lectures, and then so you're telling the students, well, look, you know, you're going to go out into the community and get your hands on things. And so,
right.
You know, was there something you had to prepare them for to do that, or was it completely out of left field for them?
You know, it was quite complicated. This was all happening within the context of a transformation on campus. As we had a group of faculty members really sort of start to engage in community-based research in a big way. I mean, today, I think if you say community-based research or service learning or experiential learning, whichever sort of code word you want to use, Rollins is very well known for that. We've gotten the President's Award, the President of the United States Award for being the most engaged campus. We got a Carnegie Foundation designation for most engaged campus and so on and so forth. But this was many years ago. I mean, this was like, you know, seven years ago, six years ago at least. And it wasn't quite so clear. And so we were in the midst of creating an institutional support structure, you know, the creation of the Office of Community Engagement, which was a new office. And faculty members really trying to create the structure associated with community engagement. So students had an idea of what they thought it was, but their idea was really sort of dominated by a kind of high school volunteering kind of model, which is exactly not what it was. Like, in fact, as you say, if you were signing up for the class, you were literally signing up to go out and interact with people in a way that you had to be prepared for. And we developed things like paperwork. So I guess a kind of instruction sheet. This is what it is. A contract. You sign this contract. You recognize by signing this contract that you are going to be involved in community-based research, and that it would require additional time beyond the normal time associated with the class. We also had sort of tried to develop a process of reflection associated with having done the exercise. You know, volunteerism, you sort of do when you're done. With community-based research, you kind of have to contextualize how is the community reflecting some of the things that you're reading about in theory in the history books. And, you know, sort of close that loop so you get the full effect of having done the exercise. And at the same time, you know, from the community standpoint, you have to be mindful that you don't want to send the students out and their activities somehow create disruptions or injury to the community. And so there was a dialogue that had to be done in class, and there was a dialogue that had to be done with the community partner to recognize what the process was, because the community partner sometimes would be thinking about it, well, they're volunteers. And I was always always wanted to emphasize, well, no, they're not simply volunteers. Their end product has to be something that's beneficial and educational, right? It doesn't do any good for them to come in and sweep the floors. That's not our goal. On the other hand, if they come in and like they make an exhibit for the history museum, well, that's a better goal. And indeed, for me personally, my relationship to the community-based research evolved because I recognized that there was also some developmental issues. You know, I came to understand that you should not have freshmen or sophomores doing certain kinds of engagement, but it was okay if juniors and seniors were doing certain kinds of engagement. And, you know, the interactions with archival resources became much more important at the freshman and sophomore level. And then more complicated, field-oriented, community-based research became the norm at the upperclassmen level. And all those things, of course, affected how you constructed the syllabi, constructed the assignment. You know, whatever the community-based research was going to be had to be constructed very carefully so that you got my goal was to get greater synergy in terms of both the end product for the community partner and also the learning in the classroom. And so those things became really big parts of the planning process and big parts of what the student expected. And very quickly, since so many people on campus were doing that, we went from people not quite knowing what community engagement was to like, oh, community engagement is this, to, okay, now we have a community engagement designation for a course. You have to do this paperwork, and you have to have so many sort of like benchmarks associated with having that CE designation attached to your course. And so now there's like a whole culture associated with it that's grown up from our sort of individual experiences, and then that's become a kind of like institutional knowledge, and that's become sort of streamlined and sort of common practice.
You know, in your response, you had me thinking about something too. I know your students worked on a Hannibal Square project, and of course, you know, Hannibal Square was the African American section of Winter Park that, you know, some say and some not say was gentrified, and, you know, we won't talk about whether that's true or not here. However, it did represent a difficult history. And so did you have any specific challenges for having to have students go out and engage when there is a difficult history to be learned?
Yes, in fact, you know, because of my focus on urban development and issues of urban culture and race, this has become like an area that I touch on repeatedly. So, you know, one of the partner groups that I work very closely with is the Hannibal Square Community Land Trust, and and many times doing the project with that group, this controversy over what happened is right at the center of the project. I mean, the students have to try to discern these many voices. And I remember one project that we did in my Urban America class, History of Urban America class, and they went and they spoke to, they did oral histories with people in the planning office in the city of Winter Park, residents in Hannibal Square, developers that were working in the area. And, you know, we did archival work, looked at the newspaper, saw the sort of transformation as it's played out in the newspaper archives about Hannibal Square, some of the controversies that spilled over related to this question of gentrification, and then talked to the people who were sort of working and living in the environment created by those tensions. And it was very interesting because, of course, the students, you know, in that class, that particular class, we actually read a great book on what gentrification is, which is a very complicated, hard to define process. I mean, there's a lot of give and take on whether or not gentrification is good or bad, and also huge questions about what's driving it. But there's also, of course, some economic and social consequences to development, regardless of where it is. And so, you know, in a History of Urban America class, it was great because they were going out, talking to planners, talking to developers, reading about urbanization, exurbs, sprawl, rising housing costs, and government policies throughout the 20th century. And so they really got a chance to see the complexity of the issue. And often they came back exactly what you – feeling exactly how you would expect them to feel, deeply confused and conflicted, right? Like, that's exactly what you, like exactly what you expect. Like, there's on the surface, it may seem like, well, this doesn't seem fair. And we would actually talk about this in class. Well, it's not fair. Well, fair, that's one designation. But is it illegal? Well, no. Well, what's driving when you say it's not fair, what do you mean? And so it was a very interesting class, and deeply, you know, there's no question that they learned a lot doing that class, but they were also very, very much in several moments caught up in the politics of development, the politics of race around development, to good effect. I mean, I whatever discomfort they had, I think that discomfort added to their understanding of some very broad, very complicated issues related to urban development. And that was always, you know, that's always a great outcome when you think about classes like this.
And so I know you were telling me about this project you're going to be working on in a new class, right, in the fall?
Right, yeah.
So can you briefly tell me a little bit about what's that about?
Yeah, you know, once again, teaching the history of urban America, and especially now in a sort of post-Great Recession landscape, deeply interested in these questions of disruption in terms of the urban environment, and also interested in a sort of persistent dreams associated with the urban environment. So we're going to be doing a project where the students are going to be creating some radio documentaries / podcast. I say radio documentary because, of course, we have WPRK on campus, and so there's a real possibility that we will broadcast these documentaries that they're going to be creating. But at the same time, we'll also put them on online. And what we're going to be looking at, we're going to be looking at the Hamilton Square Land Trust, which it's really sort of rooted in a sort of 1960s social liberalism reform aesthetic, right? These are the land trust idea, so that grows out of a kind of community reaction to inequality, very much rooted in like 1960s, and so it draws its inference from Indian as in India social movements and that model has been very successful in some very sort of well-known examples. Burlington, Vermont has a very huge land trust, is very successful. And the land trust idea, of course, is to take land out of the housing equation. And if you take land out of the housing equation, you reduce prices, and so you allow low to moderate income people a chance to get into the housing market, and therefore give them the chance to sort of build equity and so they can move up through the housing market. The big barrier for so many people is getting into their first home. And so this model is supposed to help with that. And that's a very 1960s model. But there's another model that's very interesting. It also has some examples in the Central Florida area, and that's the co-working model, which was another sort of reaction to disruption associated with the urban environment. But it's disruption, of course, in the late 1990s, tech dot-com bubble, where, you know, the emergence of the sort of information service economy, the first flourishes in the 1990s, led to a kind of emerging first generation, I would argue, sort of creative class. The creative class sort of marker has been very much popularized by Richard Florida. So that co-working space was a space where these sort of information technology workers, these sort of people who internet and this internet 1.0 really were going to be, you know, creating this sort of new economy attached to internet commerce, e-commerce. Those people weren't going to be working in a normal factory anymore. They were going to need like a new space. And so you saw these co-working spaces, which were basically a kind of open forum that will allow these people with these very particular skill sets to move into work on projects collaboratively, you know, give birth to like the next sort of mega successful internet startup was always the model in people's minds. And these spaces were very much attached to the sort of positive aspect of that first explosion of e-commerce in the late 1990s. Now you fast forward to, you know, post Great Recession period, and I think there's a huge question about the validity of both of those models at some level. I mean, the co-working spaces, in fact, you can find several co-working spaces all across Central Florida. In particular, we're going to be working with Urban Rethink, which is in Thornton Park. And the goal here is to really sort of get down to the root of why people are interacting and working in this space, and how do they see it operating in terms of the economy. And the same thing is true of the Hannibal Square land trust model. You want to talk to the people and, you know, intersect and try to, like, dissect and see how they're intersecting with, like, the sort of the transformations associated with the economy, and how is that going to work in the sort of new millennium. And we're going to be reading some classic works associated with, like, urban decline and transformation that sort of looked at the sort of problem of deindustrialization, not just simply recently, but really starting back in the mid-20th century, and try to connect that up to some of these ideas sort of being put forward by Richard Florida, and try to understand what are the mechanisms, both in terms of what the literature says, but also in terms of like what people are believing and experiencing on the ground. And so the students are going to be going out, doing interviews, splashing those up, creating sort of audio documentaries, and those are going to be their papers. And of course, the benefit for both institutions is that both of them are always interested, I know, in how people are perceiving what they are doing, you know. And they also are interested in people knowing that they exist. I mean, it's all well and good that you say that you exist. It's often very difficult for organizations like this to get penetration into the consciousness. The people who care the most are often the people who are most against it, and the people who are most for it. And those tend to be two extremes in the population. The vast majority of people are unaware that perhaps a co-working space like Urban Rethink exists in Thornton Park, or they're unaware of what the sort of motivations are for a land trust, or don't even know that there is a land trust in Winter Park. And so for them, partnering with us and allowing the students to sort of interact with their facilities and the members of their organization gives them a chance to share their story. And so the students will learn more by interacting with the personnel of these two organizations, but also thinking about, from the classroom perspective, thinking about framing these two organizations within this broad question of disruptions associated with urban development and trying to understand how these mechanisms that are creating these very distinct historical periods are answering questions associated with the transformation of the city or the transformation of the urban experience. And so it should be interesting, hope, whenever you sort of go out in the community, you start with like it'll be interesting and you end with like, oh my God, I wish this will be over soon. But that's just the nature of the process.
You're right. So for our listeners, if they want to find you and maybe check out some of these past projects and maybe look into these coming projects, where could they find you on the internet?
JulianChambliss.com. So okay. You'll find me with that.
Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed Dr. Chambliss's interview and are interested in his projects, please follow him on the internet by visiting his website, JulianChambliss.com.